This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Media, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Pete Kunze. My guest today is Hille Stangard-Jensen, Associate Professor in the Department of History and Classical Studies at Aarhus University, Denmark, and the author of Sensory Street, A Transnational History. The book was published by Oxford University Press in 2023. Good evening, Hille. How are you tonight?
I'm good, thank you. And how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and training as we get started?
Yes, I can. So I'm an MA in history and Danish and from Roskilde University, which is a sort of problem-oriented project-focused research university in Denmark. And then I've done a PhD in history at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy. And I've been I've done fellowships in the US and then the UK, Sweden, Norway. So I've been in a lot of places. Now I'm, as you said, an associate professor in history and classical, in the Department of History and Classical Studies at Aarhus University. I also co-direct the Center for Digital History in Aarhus. So I do a lot of digital history in my sort of daily teaching.
Excellent, excellent. So how do you get from history and digital history in particular to talking about Sesame Street? I mean, for many children around the world, it was a staple of education and entertainment. So what piqued your interest in turning to it as a historian?
Well, so actually, it's for my MA thesis, which was at this university that I went to that is sort of, research-focused, problem-oriented, half a PhD, basically. It's your MA thesis. But I did something on the influence of 68 and counterculture on Danish children's television. And during the thesis, I found this frog, which was not Kermit the Frog. I've never watched Sesame Street as a child because it was never bought by Danish children's television. But there is another frog on Danish children's television, which is called Kai. But he's like a jazz frog, and he will teach you about not numbers and letters, but jazz, standing up to adult authorities and being friends with a parrot. And I found out that he was inspired by Kermit the Frog. So that got me really interested in Sesame Street and what that was and this inspiration, because the producer who was very inspired by Kermit to make this Danish frog, he talked a lot in his papers about like how he liked some of Sesame Street but not all of it, and this sort of very sort of contrasted it was fear and fascination relationship with Sesame Street. It really piqued my interest as an MA student. But then I did my PhD, but something completely different. And then I, when I came back after doing my PhD, I was like, the system history, it hadn't left me that that would be an excellent sort of prism for understanding childhood in and the relationship between childhood and television and education in many different countries would be a good, like, because I had failed cases and I had successful cases, and it would be a great thing to do, like, to do a comparative study on.
Excellent. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, in the last few years, there have been several kind of popular books, academic books. I believe there was a documentary based on Street Gang, which was very kind of nostalgic and laudatory about Sesame Street. How does your book differ in its approach from these other takes on Sesame Street we've seen in journalism and academia? And in particular, what do you feel a transnational approach brings that previous studies may have missed or even neglected?
So I think a lot of things when you tell me this, and of course I've been following, so actually I've been writing this book since 2014. I've published another book in between, but it's a long sort of project that I've been working on. And I've done quite a lot of like memory studies and Twitter and Sesame Street. So I see all these sort of nostalgic and very celebratory tales about Sesame Street often in that Twitter study. But I think, you know, comparison, like, so comparative history and also global history, transnational history, all this where you compare and you look at sort of how do things travel and not travel, gives you, it also turns around domestic history. So lots of the history that's been written about Sesame Street is focused on the US or individual countries, but comparing countries and also having this global angle turns, you know, you see what you miss or how you could, you know, what's missing in all of these, when you compare them, for instance, that the business of Sesame Street is rarely touched upon in these sort of Street Gang, you know, both the book and the film, but also there's the Sunny Days. And look, often, you know, the business side of things or ideas of childhood as from childhood media studies, rarely touched upon. So that's really, really different. Also, there's that you see that ideas of childhood and education and TV viewership can come across as quite conservative sometimes in a US context in Sesame Street when you compare it to what's happening in Europe at the same time. So it changes this domestic history and it changes a narrative. Also, this following the money, the business model, that is very different from the stories that you normally get. Well, so money is not, you know, as cute as the Muppet, and it's not nostalgic. It's definitely, money's dirty sometimes.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think a few years ago when Sesame Street left public television in the United States and went to HBO, there was this kind of blowback, understandably, of like, you're desecrating a part of our childhood, you know, something that was meant for working class children and for children of color is now going to be increasingly inaccessible. And I think one of the things your history kind of hits upon is that there are always these kinds of commercial and capitalist efforts behind Sesame Street. And particularly when we look in a transnational or global approach, we see kinds of, you know, potentially cultural imperialist frameworks come to mind, but also kind of countering that with kind of media proximity. And I think that that's one of the things your study does really well is show us that, yeah, sometimes it went into these places with American politics, you know, in tow, and other times they had to localize the content because, you know, governments, particularly in Western Europe, as you focus in your study, were kind of like, yeah, no, we see what's going on here, and it doesn't jive with what we're interested in. But yeah, I mean, we'll get more into that in a bit. But I'm to begin, I guess the, I'm fascinated by the methodology here because you're traveling to 7 different countries, covering 11 archives. Can you tell us about this research process and, you know, how do you track down and organize all the information you're getting, and even figure out where it's at?
Well, it's been a I started in 2014, where I got some grants from the European Union and the Danish Research Council. So that it enabled me to travel to a lot of places. Also, thanks to my husband, who actually came with me and with our son. And so we've stayed abroad for quite a long time. Also, actually, I did some of it already when we were leaving, when I knew we were leaving Italy. So I've been fortunate to be able to travel to all these places. I think it's been a sort of kind of snowballing with, you know, seeing, so I go to one archive in Germany, I see, well, some of it is in another archive, or I go to one archive in Sweden, I see, oh, some of it is in Norway. But also getting it growing organically, seeing that I want these countries, not, you know, like selecting countries. But I've organized all of my material in a program called Tropy, which is developed by George Mason, the Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media, I think it's called. And that's been excellent. So I've because it enables you to create an archive of your own. And, you know, you can tag people. So I have, if I find people in my material from the US, I tag them and their names and the places. Also, I see, you know, some of the US material talking about Scandinavia, talking about Latin America. I tag those, and then I can tag across. I can actually gather material across that's fit for my own conceptual model, the analytical levels that I want to look at in this really big database where I have all of the material in there, and also I have all the metadata that I've, you know, put in myself. And so really, that really helped me. And also, at some point, I figured out that one of the analytical levels, I wanted to have like a global level. So even though I'm focusing mostly in Western Europe, I wanted to see how children's television workshops marketing to a global audience in Latin America, in Australia, in Japan, how that impacted the business strategy in local cases. So like, for instance, Scandinavia. And then I knew that I wanted to compare, for instance, Western Germany to Scandinavia to Britain. So organizing the material entropy, being able to create like the perfect archive for my exact study was phenomenal. I wouldn't have been able to do this kind of big comparative study, I think, as well without that software.
Yeah, as I was reading it, I was marveling at how not only were you able to find all this stuff, because as you rightly note, those of us who work on children's media and children media histories, a lot of that stuff wasn't saved, right? It was seen as culturally devalued. It's seen as ephemeral, particularly if it's television or some other kind of daily entertainment. And to see how much of it was actually preserved, particularly from an industrial side of things, was really great to see in the study.
I ran into problems because there are different, like, so for comparative studies, you want something, you know, units of comparison to be, you know, good and substantial. So I thought I wanted Italy and France in there at first, but they are not case studies on their own, because that simply wasn't possible because the material wasn't kept. Mm-hmm. I went to the Italian archives every day for 2 months because I was like, I don't believe you don't have anything, but they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I talk to my students about that when I teach history and historiography, right? It's, you don't go into the archive with a question. You go into the archive, you see what they have, and then you build the questions out from what you can find.
Yes, it's definitely an iterative process.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. So let's go back to the beginning. And I know this has been covered a lot in earlier Sesame Street scholarship, but many of our listeners may not know it. Can you tell us a little bit about how Sesame Street got developed by the Children's Television Workshop? And in particular, how was it actually closely aligned with 1960s US social policy?
Yeah, so I think definitely, you know, as you point to 1960s US sort of social policy, the Johnson government, Head Start, the war on poverty, that is very, very important. So thinking about, welfare for all of, for all Americans, and thinking about education as well. But I think also here, education goes further back. Actually, I think it's very important to think about Cold War and to think about Sputnik, launched in 1957 by the Soviet Union or by the Russians. That is sort of seen to in educational history to be like a wake-up point for at least some parts of the US, where you're like, oh well, you know, they got this, you know, a satellite, and now, you know, we've fallen behind in STEM and we have to do something. So I think in terms of education and the educational system, as something where the Johnson government's focus on equality of opportunity, as the educational system as somewhere that you can sort of not save but improve equality of opportunity for all Americans, also minorities, that is very important for Sesame Street, like for the development of Sesame Street, to understand this. Because actually, you could say from a European perspective, comparative European perspective, thinking about the educational system as somewhere where the individual can improve their way of life, the individual can get to, you know, live the American dream, is a very individually focused way of thinking about how to improve society, rather than to think about like big structural changes, to think about like, well, this educational system might actually be biased in some way. But Sesame Street is a solution where you think about the individual child doing better when it gets into the preschool child being better prepared for school. So, you know, if you can teach them numbers and letters and other sort of cognitive school-like type skills, then they will do better in the educational system. So you think about, you know, improving, you could say, the individual child rather than the educational system. And that is that ties in very well with the way that the Johnson government is thinking at this moment. So it's a, you know, very liberal American way of thinking.
Yeah, I actually studied at the University of Texas at Austin, which has President Johnson's presidential library is there. And I think what people may not realize, because his reputation in the United States is kind of Johnson as this kind of aggressive, macho, effective legislator and negotiator, but he actually was trained as a school teacher. And that kind of gets perhaps glossed over in his legacy, but, you know, education programs were so central to him, going back to his time working with Mexican-American children in Texas. And it's interesting to see how, you know, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Children's Television Workshop, and of course, Joan Ganz Cooney, who comes up a lot in your study, of course, are kind of central towards developing the show, and how it intersects with education policy, how it intersects with cognitive psychology at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. Cognitive psychology, and also because of the funding from the first funding comes from the Carnegie Foundation, or the Carnegie Foundation, and they really emphasize cognitive psychology at this point in time. That's way, you know, that is also their way to solve poverty crisis. That's the way to solve inequality in the American society. So there's really this focus on education, but also that the current education, so Joan Ganz Cooney is not very happy with the progressive education. She's like, well, there's way too much sort of like social and cultural learning in these, you know, preschool programs. I want want, or we want, focus on, like, you know, numeracy, literacy. So there is also in Sesame Street is a criticism of the educational system in the US that ties really well in with, you know, the criticism, you know, from more conservative leaning policymakers. Mm.
Excellent, excellent. So as a show on this emerging public broadcasting, nationwide public broadcasting, of course, the United States had localized public broadcasting before then, but this was really about putting in place a nationwide public broadcasting that could be educational. So Sesame Street is incredibly available and accessible around the country. And it has a very different mandate than most industrially produced children's entertainment. So how did the Children's Television Workshop position Sesame Street in the market? And how did it perhaps position itself against things coming out of Walt Disney Productions, for instance?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. I think also the Children's Television Workshop, or Sesame Workshop, as it's called now, has been very good at sort of emphasizing some parts of their history and not others. And I think what I was surprised about sometimes was how this is also a business model, positioning you as somebody who fills a void in a market, right? And that was also what they did when they thought, like, when they were out looking for funding, saying, like, this is not, you know, this is what American children need. This, you know, this is not, doesn't exist on their current market. But they were actually very comfortable with going to Disney, for instance, seeking out funding like that. And they also tried to get Sesame Street on commercial networks at first, but it wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. And then came the alliance with PBS, which they really benefit from, like, that, you know, that really positions them as something different. Also because Joan Gans Cooney is like, you know, we don't want we don't want commercials within the broadcast. We don't want sponsorships, but because there's the funding from Carnegie, funding from Ford, funding from the government, so it's not commercially funded, and that makes you stand out on this market, right? So it's also a way to go to your funders and say, like, we fill in this void. We are not the vast wasteland, but it needs to be for everybody. And I think this is really important. Like, yes, there is this, they say, well, we want to do something especially for what they call underprivileged children, which, you know, is mostly Afro-American children, minority children, but it has to be for everyone, because you cannot put something on a mass medium and a public service broadcasting if you don't got everybody to watch it. And that's also why they operate with this ideal model child from cognitive psychology, where they say, well, there is just, like, this idea of this four-year-old, what can a four-year-old do? And that's not, it's a very cognitive science, cognitive psychology model, where you don't consider social, cultural backgrounds of the kids and the interests that they might lead to, or the differences in learning patterns that might lead to.
Excellent. Thank you. So let's talk a little bit more about Sesame Street and the Children's Television Workshop as a business. I think this is a really important aspect of your book. And one of the things that comes through is that it was also a cross-media franchise, right? We think of Sesame Street as a television series, but that was just one component of the business model, of the narrative structure of the series, of its educational mission. Can you tell us a little bit more about the business strategies you uncovered, and how did you find them?
Yeah, I was very interested in the business strategies also because they haven't really been covered in much of the scholarship, also domestically from a US side. And also because this was much of the motivation for to take the show abroad. It was very clear from the beginning that it wasn't financially viable. So you had to make money, you know, because you couldn't, you know, fund, somebody like the Carnegie Award, they'll only give you for the first two seasons, three seasons, perhaps, and then continue with a little bit, but they will never fund all of it, right? And you have this quite big work. The workshop is big. It's a big corporation. And so you need to get your money from somewhere. And well, once you've said, like, we don't want commercials, we don't want sponsorships, where is it going to come from? It's going to come from what they call non-broadcast, but which is really merchandise, right? So there's all this Sesame Street merchandise, like bed linen, toys, booklets, games, lots, and it's really fascinating. And they had to sell it to bring in, you know, money to keep the show going. And also the alliance with books makes sense because parents, especially middle-class parents, love books. So a way to, you know, say like, oh, your children will learn numbers and letters, like they will learn how to maybe take the first steps in reading. That alliance really makes sense. That gives you a lot of, you know, credibility, gives you a lot of goodwill. But I think one of the fascinating cases that I look into was this, you know, at first, everything that they produced that were merchandise had to be educational, and they tested it. But then at some point, it's like, we can't test this. We can't do all of the test setup like we have with the broadcast. We just have to be able to sell it. And then it's like, yeah, as long as it's non-gimmicky, we can sell it. And then there's also the alliance with Action for Children's Television, which is also anti-commercial, like there's this alliance of seeing like, not, you know, you're non-profit, you can say you're against commercials, but really you have to sell quite a lot of merchandise, and you have to also then sell abroad, the broadcasting, sell it abroad. So that's why I really looked into the financing and the budget, and it's really interesting, like follow the money is quite interesting for cultural history to then, you know, look at the financial side. That gives something that's really different.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Absolutely, absolutely. And your mention of Action for Children's Television reminded me of Heather Hendershot's work on Peggy mm-hmm. Sharon. And
yes, yes.
And learning how to, you know, and what was interesting in reading Hendershot's book, right, was that, you know, Sharon realized she couldn't go in and advocate censorship, that she had to work with a lot of these people, and how she was effective at doing it. I mean, this is a really important dimension of children's media and the media culture more broadly. And it's exciting when we get more into the policy and the economics. And just the sheer financing of these things, especially if they're going to have this anti-commercial ethos, but at the mm-hmm. same time, there's mm-hmm. capitalist practices at work, right?
Yeah, and I go really into detail with this selling but appearing not to sell strategy. Like that's I think that was fascinating, and I really try to describe it, like how that actually works. How do you craft such a strategy, and how are you so successful with crafting such a strategy? That's just really fascinating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's shift now toward when the Children's Television Workshop decides to pursue non-US markets. Mm-hmm. How early in the history of Sesame Street does that happen? And how well do those initial efforts go?
happens very early and they go very well at first. Actually, I found like as early as 1968, so even before it airs in the US, there is the Children's Television Workshop places sort of this three-page information article about their work in a German magazine for broadcasters, which is widely read in Europe at this point in time. And it's clear from other, like that it's read outside of Germany because people definitely know about the workshop very early. So that's, you know, that I found that fascinating that is really early and that they're, you know, aware of this magazine and they're aware of like potential markets, really. It's not really selling at this point. It's more like information about what we're doing and this cool thing we have going on that you might be interested in.
Sure.
And then in like late 69, and they start approaching BBC, which is a gatekeeper to Commonwealth market at this point. And also then they enter in early, very, very early, I don't know if it's late 69 or early 1970, they enter Sesame Street for this Apprisionnaise, which is a huge children's film television festival at this point in time. Like if you have a children's television program and you want it to be seen by the world, that is where you enter for that competition. And that's really successful because Sesame Street actually wins one of the prizes in 1970. So it's seen by there are broadcasters from more than 30 countries on four continents at this festival. So it's really seen by the world. And then they also, and this is fascinating, they employ sales agents. Like I've never seen any of those sales agents mentioned in any work I've really studied lots of Sesame Street historiography and I might have overlooked something, but the children's, they employ people from Britain and people from France. So they have sales agents in both London and Paris it's in 1970. So it's really early and it goes quite well in the beginning the London-based agents, they're able to sell quite widely to the world. They also have they're very industrious and very commercial in the way that they approach this. The Paris-based agents are less successful. They're trying to figure out how to co-produce with affluent European broadcasters, but eventually they're actually also able to prepare this market. You know, quite early on, this strategy, and it is the strategy. It's not something Sesame Workshop says is coincidental, and people just, you know, saw that this was an amazing thing going on in the US. But that's not how cultural transfer happens, right? Somebody has to, you know, make it seen. Somebody has to see it. And then, of course, there's Latin America, which is also approached. So the Sesame Workshop is very involved in getting Sesame Street to Latin America for a pan Latin American Spanish version from early 1970. But the financial setup in that one is really shaky, despite they get $1 million from Cirrus. But they actually try to get Coca-Cola to sponsor it first, which is interesting in terms of like cultural imperialism, I guess.
Absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? Like, what are you're kind of gesturing towards some obstacles and some roadblocks that they faced in this process. What were some of the criticisms that the Children's Television Workshop faced in these markets, particularly in Western Europe?
So there's lots of the different things, but overall, for instance, in Western Europe, you have a tradition for, you have public service broadcasting. So being an alternative to commercial broadcasting is not a good selling point in Western Europe, because you have very little commercial broadcasting, and the commercial broadcasting you have is very, very regulated. But also progressive education is really on the rise. And that means also like a much more child-centered way of thinking about what do children need in terms of children's television. They need something that talks to them as already beings, as human beings who need, you know, to be culturally stimulated, talked about as a social group, for instance. What are their interests? So a very sort of the very hardcore educational approach, that which is the one that I know that Sesame Street is also fun and lots of music and Muppets, and but they what they try to sell Sesame Street as is this educational philosophy that you can teach via television. And Europeans just not interested in that, because they're like, we have schools. Schools will take care of that.
Absolutely.
We want to have a cultural education, cultural stimulation, arts and crafts and things like that. So Sesame Street ends up looking a bit conservative to Europeans, actually, because of this sort of strict education, like educational emphasis that it's being sold on. And also there is a, you know, copying commercials as a technique to get children glued to the screen for an hour. You know, you don't have any shows that is an hour long at this point in time in Western Europe for children. It's there like 15, 20, 25 minutes. But also you have a schedule approach. So you have like, if you have something informational, you have that, you know, in one program, and then you have something entertaining in another program. You don't mix them, like, because it's all made within one department in Europe. You know, it's not different competitors, like, you know, Sesame Workshop has this one thing, whereas a European broadcaster is like, well, we have, you know, news for kids, we have cartoons for kids, and we all do it, like, you know, in the same schedule, and we all collaborate on these things. So it's very different. And that's an obstacle also, because Children's Television Workshop sometimes has a little it's a little difficult for them to get this. The cultural sensitivity is not always sort of very fine-tuned.
And this leads nicely into my next question, which is one of the important interventions in this book, I feel like, is your focus on the child viewer, and particularly how this audience is constructed by these shows, right? Because it's not that Sesame Street was just taken from the US and broadcast around the world. It was localized to different markets. So can you tell us a little bit about how it's modified in different markets and in different contexts, in part because different children, or what children need, what children want, what children are getting or not getting is markedly different in different areas of the world. So can you talk more about how that is informing your approach and some of the what you uncovered?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's localized very differently in very different countries. It's like the more money you want to pay to work together with Children's Television Workshop, the more localized the product you can get. So that's also interesting. So for instance, one of my case studies is Western Germany. I think it's fascinating because it's one of the first co-productions after Latin America. So the workshop starts co-producing in Latin America, and they're like, it's a very different setup. So they want a new setup for Western Germany, and they get that. But in West Germany, you come out of the Second World War, and the experience of the war and the way in which the war is interpreted at this point in time, it has a huge impact on pedagogy and education in West Germany. And so the way in which also you see children and their relationship with adults. And it's thought to be at this point in time, you know, the way in which we can avoid having a repetition of the war, the Holocaust, you know, is to have a more critical, have children be more critical to be able to stand up to adult authorities. So the child, the children are seen as a social group that needs to be able to think on their own, be empowered, stand up, speak back, be much more anti-authoritarian, to see themselves as equals with adults in some ways. And this is a very child-centered focus. And so the Germans, they want this to be the focus of the German local production, Sesamstraße. But there's a huge pushback on that from the American side, actually. And it's only because financially, the Children's Television Workshop cannot lose Germany as a market, because where Germany goes, rest of, like, lots of Europe goes. So if this fails, and that's financial, that leverage is actually how the Germans can say to the Americans, you know what, we want this anti-authoritarian education, we want to empower children, you know, we want to show them as equal as adults. We and there are some great examples, I think, in of how this plays out actually in the book. And so that's one of the ways that is, you know, you really see this negotiation of what is localization and how also financing makes that work.
And so in that spirit, I'm curious, because we've already talked about cultural imperialism, right? And I'm wondering about the other side of it, right? Which is cultures, contexts, where the viewers were like, no, thank you, we're good. So can you tell us a little bit about places where Sesame Street failed, or at least stumbled for a period before it got its footing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the UK is another case study here, and that's about, like, the BBC doesn't want it. There's something about fake letters and lawyers, and so really intriguing, and ITV takes it. So that's one, you know, you could have one broadcaster not take it and another just, you know, take it. But I think the third case study is Scandinavia, where it's, you know, just reject. Like, there's a fascination, as I told you, with Kermit, for instance. Like, okay, so everybody in Europe loves the Muppets, the music and the Muppets, that's, you know, and Bert and Ernie, and everybody wants to buy just segments with the Muppets, and even the BBC wants to buy segments with the Muppets, but, like, Children's Television Workshop is like, no, we have a philosophy, it's tied in with all this educational setup, the research, the testing, so you buy that or nothing, really. And the Scandinavians, they try for like a year, 2 years, 3 years even, to collaborate, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, about a Nordic version. But it completely fails because Scandinavia at this point in time, they're really used to collaborating also with no profit. Like, they're all public service. So they just swap segments and they don't pay for those things. They then, you know, I give you something, you give me something, collaborate together. And they really don't, I think the Scandinavians are very sort of naive. Like, they don't get how the Americans, they need to, you know, it's their brand, it's their IP. they don't get that. The Americans on their side are like, you're just like rogue. Like, we can't understand what you want. And also, you know, all this anti-authoritarianism, it's too much. Like, it's not. So that completely fails. Then Sweden takes, you know, this Open Sesame, which is a spin-off, which Sweden eventually buys. But it's really interesting to look at this, because often we don't get to study cultural demarcation. But there are so many, I found so many sources from this, like the negotiations, also the Scandinavians, how they call each other on the phone and they talk about, like, what they think about the Americans, and the Americans talk about, you know, have internal memos about what they think about the Scandinavians. And it's been fascinating having this archival material where you have the letters that are outgoing, you have the internal letters that you know, circulated before even the outgoing letters. Then you have the reception in that country, and you have like internal discussions with other countries or even on a European level, and you have what's going back. So it's been really multi-layered sort of cultural transfer. It's been fascinating to see, you know, what you keep inside your organization and what you send out is not the same at all.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about production cultures, you know, in media industries research, right? But then to think about how they are constructed transnationally, right? Because often work on production cultures is like, oh, let's look at a set in Hollywood or maybe a, you know, a runaway production in Toronto or here in my town of New Orleans. But to think about a production culture that in some ways is not only a literal space, but becomes this kind of metaphorical space, right? Where like the Scandinavians and the Americans working across, you know, around the world are trying to kind of make something happen through this transnationalization of Sesame Street. I mean, it's super interesting and generative.
And it also pushes this children's television workshop to rethink what is our brand, how little can we sell without losing the integrity of the brand, and also the merchandise that they need to sell with the brand. Like, they need a lot of brand recognition. That was one of the problems in France. Like, they're like, the way in which it's broadcast, you know, you don't see that it's our brand. Like, we absolutely need that. Because that's one of the ways it's crucial for us to sell all the merchandise that comes with it. And I think also the way, like, I've enjoyed not only working with sort of, you know, Americans working with, you know, Germans or Scandinavians, but also see, like, how did the Danes, the Germans, and the Brits talk together about the Americans when they weren't in the room in the European broadcasting, for instance? Or how did Germans, when they argued for or against, draw upon experiences that they had seen other people have with co-production in Latin America? That's really absolutely fascinating to be able to explore, to have this rich material to explore the global level and its impact on a local level.
Absolutely. And to see, too, in some ways, discursively, they were positioning themselves against, at least in the U.S. context, like Filmation and Hanna-Barbera and, you know, the violence or the nonsense of those shows.
And they saw themselves very much as, you know, when going to Europe, you have a television fair that's the equivalent of the Cannes Film Fair. You have the Cannes Television Fair. And so they strategized before going, saying, like, we should not come across like, you know, Hanna-Barbera. We are not like them. Mm. We should be more we're more classy. We don't push our product. We just display it in a way so that people can avoid seeing it.
Right. I mean, it's fascinating to think about these intersections of progressive education and kind of liberal elitism, right? Like that great society thinking of, like, we know how to save the downtrodden and how it manifests itself in these media cultures as well. As we kind of head into the final stretch here, one of the many rewards of your book is reassessing Sesame Street's intentions, practices, and legacies, as we've been doing in our conversation here. How do you think your history is challenging these received notions of Sesame Street as altruistic, anti-commercial, maybe even some people might even mistake it for socialist in its efforts and its management? And I think your history kind of points to ways that it's not. I mean, do you feel that you're kind of going after a sacred cow here?
I don't know. It's it's been difficult, right? It's like, I didn't set out to dig into dirt. Like, I should have, maybe that was naive of me, like, following money. It's not, you know, it's not cute. But it's been fascinating to follow the materiality of transfer and see, you know, things doesn't, you know, they don't spread into the world just because people find them fascinating. Like, there are lots of things that are fantastic, which stay local because they're never marketed outside. You know, it has to spread in some way, right? It's not, you're not as a European broadcaster in 1970s thinking like, oh, what's going on in the US? You can't Google it. You can't watch it on YouTube. You can't see it anywhere. So if you have a show in the US, you make it travel. And that's been fascinating. And I think, but also I think, you know, it wasn't, you know, on the US market, Sesame Street wasn't financially viable. There was no business model where it could stay, you know, anti-commercial. It just couldn't, because how was it supposed to make money? It couldn't do it. So they had to seek revenue elsewhere. And I think also there was this really this sense that we are helping people. We, you know, we are doing something good for the world. We believe in cognitive, you know, cognitive psychology, the model child, psychonometrics. We do, you know, this fascinating science of psychology. You know, they talked about often as the show as culture free, and they really did believe in a culture free way of thinking about children, media, and education. Mm-hmm. And then there is the pushback in Europe, because there you're like, no, culture free, no. That doesn't work here. And I think also there is this really, you know, believe in equality of opportunity. You know, helping all kinds of children, underprivileged children in the US. And I think there is really, you know, I think that's very sincere. I think it's just very naive.
Mm. Yeah, no.
It's very of its time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very of its time. And, you know, we shouldn't judge people. I shouldn't have said naive. It's just, you know, it's very bound. It's a way, this way that the CTV model, which is their research, testing, and educational model, tying it in with the show, it is a very 1970s model way of thinking about childhood. That is, and I think it's been, I think childhood studies especially has been great, because there was this, you know, okay, so in Sesame Street, there are becomings, right? It's like empowering children through education to do better later in life, whereas we're like, no, we want to empower children in the here and now. We tell them about the world. We tell them about, you know, how to stand up to adult authorities. We tell them how to, you know, about sibling rivalry, jealousy, all these things that they encounter in their everyday lives, and we empower them in that way. So it's been fascinating to compare and to see, you know, how this story about Sesame Street changed when you do that.
Yeah, I think your answer there was so revealing for me and so useful, because I think there is a temptation to maybe misread your work as kind of following the strain that Disney scholarship has gone in. And I say this as a Disney scholar, right, where it's kind of like, we thought they were innocent, but they're actually, you know, rabid capitalists. And I think you make an important correction there in that kind of potentially misreading Sesame Street in the same way by saying like, no, they couldn't have survived in the American market or in the global marketplace without adapting some kinds of, you know, commercial strategies, mm-hmm. even though they were presenting this kind of anti-commercial ethos. And that kind of compromise is so fascinating and so rich. And in the latter part of your answer, I really appreciate it, not only the turn to business practices of Sesame Street, but understanding that they're historicized, right? Mm-hmm. That they're not necessarily strategies that would work today, but in that moment, with that understanding of the audience, with that understanding of the market, here's how we're going to navigate it. And that kind of work, I think, is really useful for historians and media scholars alike.
Thank you.
So what are you currently working on? It sounds like you spent many years on this one, and I you know, do you feel like you're sending your child off to school now, or are you continuing on this path with more work on Sesame Street, or are you taking a new avenue?
So I've been very fascinated. It's been great doing this project, but I think, you know, the next couple of months it'll be all about Sesame Street. But I think after that, I've received some funding from the Carlsberg Foundation, which funds a lot of humanistic and social science research in Denmark, and you can get to. So I've proposed a new monograph, where I would like to write essays about public debates about children and media. Because I'm really fascinated about the way in which these become so much more polarized, you know, also, and I'm often interviewed for Danish media about these debates. So, you know, like a drag queen, you know, making a show, you know, dressing up in a public library, you know, it copied a lot, you know, from US debates, you know what these are like. But I often find myself as an expert talking about, like, why is it when it's about children, it gets so, there's so much heat and so little light, right? It's like just, I want to look at this historically. I've done so for Scandinavia only in a previous book that was published while I actually did the system history thing. I think I also want to use web sources, so archive webs. I'm very, as a digital historian, I'm very fascinated about, like, the potential to use archive web sources. So I'm trying to look at the base in the US, the UK, and Scandinavia and compare sort of how do we discuss, you know, Teletubbies and homosexuality, or SpongeBob, and, you know, how do we look at, you know, something like screen time? So all these debates, I want to do a more popular book. I would prefer to write like 20 essays about, I think, debates about children and culture, the culture consumption. So,
I mean, just sitting here thinking about that topic in the US context, I'm thinking like the Pain Fun Studies or Seduction of the Innocent, right? In comic books. I mean, and you know, I've done some work on Saturday morning cartoons and what are Saturday morning cartoons doing to children, right? I mean, it's a really rich area, and
I would really love to work with sort of more like, you know, 80s, 90s, noughts, like, you know, like
video games.
And especially I think there's lots of potential for historians and media historians to work with archive web, which we haven't really taken advantage of yet, and I'd really like to do that.
Excellent. Well, when you finish it, hopefully you'll come back on the podcast.
Oh, it would be a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Hilla. The book is Sesame Street, A Transnational History, available now from Oxford University Press and other online booksellers. This is Pete Kunze, and this has been New Books in Media on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time.